Axel to check out one of our shows. The gig wasn't our best as we were knocking off 3 years of Rust, but it was a blast to be back on stage with the boys again and felt like home. Plus, the all-star cast and the packed crowd in attendance proved to us what we needed to know. People cared about the Fozz and were stoked to see us back. The next step was to return to our second home, the UK, where we'd always had an amazing fan base. Our return shows in Nottingham, London, and Glasgow were sold out, which blew my mind, considering there had been such a long absence since our last tour. Then we headed back to Australia, where we also had a great following, and soon after were contacted by TKO, one of the biggest booking agents in the world. They repped The Cult, Buck Cherry, and Anthrax, among others, to see if we'd be interested in working with them. I called Benanti for his advice, and he said TKO was the way to go, so we said yes later that day. One of the first shows our new agent, Dan DeVita, booked us on was the massive English festival Sonosphere, which attracted up to 80,000 fans annually and this year boasted one of my all-time favorite bands as the headliner. After 10 years of being in Fozzy and 26 years of being a fan, I was finally going to be on the same bill with the mighty Metallica. I had to sit down when I got the news because I felt like I'd been whacked over the head with the hammer from the Kill 'Em All album cover. We'd taken a lot of flack through the years, partly because of the band's humorous roots, partly because I was a wrestler, and partly because we refused to give up. It pissed a lot of people off that we continued to get bigger, but we didn't care. The one thing the haters could never question about Fozzy was our passion and love for the music we were playing. And as a result, we'd made it to the point where we were deemed worthy to play on the same bill as Metallica. Just looking at both our names on the poster, ours was a half dozen lines underneath theirs, but that's nitpicking, isn't it? Made everything we'd gone through worthwhile. Seeing the Fozzy logo on the same placard as Metallica's gave me all the mental ammunition I needed to know we could make it to the next level and tell the haters to F off. I felt like I did when I got my first magazine cover in Mexico, which verified that I wasn't too small to make it in wrestling. As big as Sonosphere was, it was only one show, and we were far from the headliners, so we weren't making a lot of money to play the festival. It's expensive to tour overseas, so to subsidize the tour, Dan booked a grab bag of other shows for us. Smaller festivals, headlining club gigs, and a handful of shows opening for Anthrax. This was different from being one of the many bands playing on the same day as Metallica at Sonosphere. This was actually directly supporting them on their headlining shows. It was surreal to be playing with Anthrax, considering in 1988 I waited outside in the freezing Winnipeg winter to buy tickets to see them open for Kiss on the Crazy Nights tour. Now here I was, over 20 years later, about to play with them with my own band. Life is pretty rad sometimes. The first show we had with Anthrax was in Lucerne, Switzerland, and we had driven in from Germany the night before. When I woke up on the tour bus in mid-morning, the rest of the band had disappeared. Rich, the Duke of Metal, was a sightseeing freak and would convince whoever he could to go along with him to check out a statue or castle with him somewhere. He would also try to convince whoever was around to eat Indian food with him. I'm not a fan and never went along. On many occasions, I sat outside an Indian restaurant eating a peanut butter sandwich, watching the guys chow down on tandoori through the window like a vagrant. Then a few hours later, I'd watch them run to the toilet in the dressing room with a case of the drizzling shits. Duke texted me that he and the guys had left to take a cable car ride up a Swiss mountain, and didn't bother asking me because he knew I wouldn't want to go. He was right, as it was a beautiful day and I wanted to find a place to go swimming, which would be a hell of a lot more fun than sitting in a tin box watching trees go by for 2 hours. Since we were in Switzerland, I figured there had to be a lake somewhere, so I put on a pair of shorts and wandered off into the parking lot. Using the Boy Scout powers I'd learned as a kid, I noticed that one part of the sky was lighter than the other, so that meant there was obviously water underneath it, right? I headed toward the fairer sky. It was a sunny day, so the whole sky was fair, but saw nothing more than brick buildings. Then a guy walked past me wearing swim trunks and flip-flops and holding a towel in his hand, and it was obvious where he was going. Accepting that my Boy Scout powers were the shits, I turned around and followed him. I was literally 2 steps behind him, and I'm sure he thought I was going to kidnap him to use as part of my very own human centipede. That actually was my plan, but it was foiled when his pace quickened and he speed-walked like Santino over a slight hill and out of sight. I followed him in vain, but when I reached the crest of the hill, I looked down at one of the most breathtaking landscapes I'd ever seen. In the small valley below lay a beautiful park, lush with green grass and sturdy trees blowing slightly in the breeze. A crystal-clear lake flowed freely through the middle of the valley, framed by the majestic silhouettes of the purple mountains surrounding it. But it wasn't just the area that was beautiful. The people roaming all around it were as well. Tall, muscular dudes and curvaceous, tanned hotties in various stages of undress were everywhere. Some were playing volleyball, others were swimming. Some were catching rays on the beach. Others were having a drink beside a big van that resembled an ice cream truck but served alcohol instead. I wandered around in a daze, hardly believing my good fortune, and laughing at the dumbness of my bandmates. While they'd chosen to see the sights of Switzerland zipping up a cable in a tin can, I was seeing all the sights of Switzerland I wanted to see right here. I found an open square of grass and inhaled the fresh air, listening to all the different languages being spoken around me, a mix of Italian, German, French, and English. The warm, sugary scent emanating from the pastry truck that had pulled up beside the bar wafted through the air, and I decided that this was the fruitiest place on earth. I had a drink, took a swim in the freezing lake, it was exhilarating, watched a volleyball game, sadly I wasn't invited to play, hashtag nerd, and sat back enjoying the moment. It's something I rarely do in a life filled with planes, trains, automobiles, buses, hotels, venues, shows, buses, cars, hotels, and more planes. That's a mistake. Not to get too preachy, but don't let life pass you by, guys. Sometimes it seems to me we have a tendency to constantly think about the next thing, the next challenge, the possibilities of what might happen the next day, both good and bad. I know, because I'm guilty as charged, but damn, it ain't right. But sometimes I force myself to take a breath and bask in the moment. Whether you're looking at a gorgeous lake in Switzerland or having a sandwich at Subway, promise me you'll do the same sometime soon, you dig? I'm glad I did, because I'm going to remember that day and that place for the rest of my life. The brightness of the sun began to fade, telling me it was time to leave the oasis and head back to the venue. It was our first night with Anthrax, and I wanted to impress them and their fans, many of whom would be seeing us for the first time. We played a decent set, but I went over the top in trying to get the crowd on our side by leading chants, telling stories, and basically begging for reactions. It worked to a degree, but much like being in the opening match on a wrestling show, there's only so much you can do to get people involved when you aren't who they paid to see. We walked off the stage to a nice Fozzy chant, which is always the goal, but due to my grandstanding, we'd gone 5 minutes over our allocated 30-minute set time. Again, like in wrestling, going overtime is a serious no-no and a real show of disrespect. Since it was the first night, I knew we'd get some leeway, but I wanted to let our bosses, and make no bones about it, the headlining band are the bosses of their show, know that we'd made a mistake. I had a great relationship with the Anthrax guys, but I still felt the need to make amends. I knocked on their dressing room door and said sorry for our mistake, guaranteeing it wouldn't happen again. They looked at me quizzically, not knowing or caring that we'd gone over, and wondering why the hell I was apologizing. I breathed a sigh of relief, and with the first half of my atonement accomplished, I went into the production office to take care of the second half, talking to their tour manager. The TM is the caretaker of the entire tour, making sure the shows are properly advanced, the dressing rooms are exactly right, the local promoters pay what they owe, and the opening bands get on and off the stage at the proper times. Anthrax's tour manager wasn't mad, but he was very clear that we weren't to go long again. He also gave me some great advice. Play more songs. What he was trying to get across was the onstage equivalent of a rock station's commercial-free slogan, less talk, more rock. I'd spent so much time talking to the fans that it had disrupted the flow of our set, which left us less time to play our tunes. When you only have 30 minutes, try to get the crowd into it with your music, not your stage rep. He was completely right, and I still think of him when I'm putting together a set list to this day. I learned another lesson by watching Anthrax play later that night, I'd seen them many times as a fan, but got a whole new perspective on how good they were by watching them from the side of the stage as a peer. It was much the same concept as when young Japanese boys learn how to wrestle while watching the main event matches from the apron side. Anthrax were so tight, and they looked like a team of assassins on stage. Everything from their background vocals to the way they moved had so much power. Joey Belladonna was a great frontman, and I don't mind saying I made a mental note of a few of his tricks and nicked them for myself. These were true pros, and even though Fozzy had come a long way as a band, I knew we still had a long way to go. The next show was in Aarhus, Denmark, a 10-hour drive from Lucerne, and Charlie invited me to ride with them on the Anthrax bus. There was no need to grab my bags as Fozzy's bus was headed to the same place, so I grabbed my toothbrush and passport, slipped on my flip-flops, and jumped on board. I was looking forward to hanging with Charlie on the ride and discuss the detailed minutiae of all things Beatles. He and I, and Mike Portnoy, had long agreed that the Fab Four were the best band of all time, and nobody could even come close to touching them. If ever the eternal Beatles versus Rolling Stones debate was brought up to us by an outside party, we would bring down the silver hammer upon their heads like Maxwell, and that would be the end of the discussion. Unlike the infamous Eddie Trunk Show Judas Priest versus Iron Maiden debate, where you could at least make a case for either band, to us there were no comparisons between John and Mick's boys, and nobody could convince us otherwise. Until Andreas Kisser came along. Andreas was the guitar player for the Brazilian band Sepultura, who was filling in for Scott Ian, who was in the U.S. with his newborn baby, on the tour, and he totally disagreed with our Beatle bias. I'd never met Andreas, but was quickly impressed with his intelligence and philosophical views, and as soon as he decreed his allegiance to the Stones, I knew Charlie and I were in for a challenge. "How can you say the Beatles are the best band of all time?" he said as he took an apple and hollowed it out with a paring knife. "They couldn't play all of their songs live, and the Stones can." It was an interesting angle to the age-old debate, and it caught our attention. "The Stones have almost 50 years of longevity," he continued, packing a large pinch of weed onto the top of the apple. "No other band in history can say that. The Beatles didn't even last for 10 years. That's pretty unimpressive." With that, he ignited his lighter in the middle of the apple and inhaled deeply. I, however, was quite impressed, both with his pro-Stones arguments and his use of an apple as a bong. I'd never seen that one before. When he was finished, Charlie and I looked at each other, our Beatle bubbles burst. For the first time ever, somebody had put the shadow of doubt in our minds that the Stones might be better than the Beatles, or at the very least could give them a run for their you-never-give-me-your-money. That made us mad. Still does. To this day, whenever I see Charlie, if I want to make him laugh, all I have to say is, "Fucking Andreas Kisser." As the ride continued, the conversation turned to the night Cliff Burton died in a bus accident in Sweden in 1986. Anthrax was on that tour with Metallica, and it was mesmerizing to hear their stories about Cliff, one of my all-time heroes, since they came through the ranks together and were very close. Charlie's favorite Burton story came from when he was watching Metallica set from the side of the stage, like I had watched Anthrax's in Lucerne. Every night before the guitar solo in Master of Puppets, Hetfield always yelled something into the mic, but Charlie could never figure out what it was. "It's fix me." When he asked Cliff what it was, he responded, "It's pancakes." I guarantee the next time you listen to Master of Puppets, you'll think James says pancakes too. That's all I ever hear at this point. Cliff's death in the bus crash was traumatic for all that survived, and the Anthrax guys still thought about it every tour. Joey even checked with the driver every night to make sure the guy was awake and feeling okay before he went to sleep. How could he not? Think about it. Part of being in a traveling rock band involves putting your life in the hands of the bus driver, who basically is a total stranger. He, or she, drives through the night while the band is fast asleep, and we don't know what he's been doing or what his personal habits are. He could be a drunken junkie, or maybe he hasn't slept in 5 days. Who the fuck knows? But we have no choice but to trust him if we want to get any sleep. And that's a scary concept. It was almost 5 a.m. and we wanted to get some sleep. So we wound down the conversation and I crashed in one of the empty bunks. When the bus stopped a few hours later, I checked my phone and saw that even though it was only 10 a.m., I already had a text from Fozzie's manager, Mark Willis. Fozzie bus in a crash. Bus is totaled. Gig in Denmark is canceled. Everybody is okay. WTF? I called Willis and found out that at 4:45 a.m., Fozzie's spare secondary driver fell asleep at the wheel and drove up a raised median, turning it into a makeshift ramp. The bus went up on two wheels and skidded at an angle for 50 feet like something out of Speed before slamming back down on all four wheels. The impact shattered the panoramic front windshield, ripped off the side bus door, almost beheading our primary driver who was sleeping in his bunk next to the door, and smashed the big-screen TV in the back lounge when it fell off the wall. It was amazing that in the midst of all the wreckage, even though the guys were shaken up, nobody was hurt and none of our gear was ruined. Even more amazing was that the Fozzie crash happened at almost the exact same time we were discussing the crash that killed Cliff Burton on the Anthrax bus. I was relieved that my brothers were okay, but they were still stuck on the side of the road somewhere in Germany, waiting for a replacement bus to come collect them. Since the gig in our house was off, I was going to have to take a train to Hamburg to meet them, and the only direct one left in 20 minutes. I had to haul ass to the station, and I was still wiping the sleep out of my eyes when I sat down in my seat 18 minutes later with only a bag of McDonald's, a toothbrush, and a pair of flip-flops to my name. The train was crowded. I sat with one person behind me and two more facing me, all of them smoking and reeking of sweat. I had nothing to read, and after 3 hours I was bored out of my skull, stomach growlingly hungry, and my back was killing me when the conductor came down the aisle checking tickets. He gave mine a glance and told me I was sitting in the wrong seat. Where was I going to move? The only seat worse than mine was the toilet in the bathroom, and that one was probably more comfortable, with a better smell. "No, sir, you have a first-class ticket. You should be sitting up in front." I traveled all over the world, but I was a European train virgin and had no idea what the little 3 meant in the corner of my ticket. I mean, Great Caesar's ghost couldn't it have at least said first class on it somewhere? I took my proper seat, and my complaining back gave me a short reprieve for the next 90 minutes until we finally reached the Hamburg station. As I was walking off the train, a businessman in dress shoes stepped on my toe, tearing the plastic strap off the flip-flop and leaving me half barefoot. I found some tape and tried to MacGruber it together, but it didn't work and I had to just tape the whole thing to my foot. I walked onto the street past a homeless man holding a tin cup, begging for change. His clothes were filthy and torn, his hair matted into natty dreads that half covered his dirty face. He was a complete shipwreck, except for the fact that he was wearing a pair of new tennis shoes that were nicer than the footwear I was sporting. He held up his cup and motioned for me to drop in a few coins. Then he glanced down at my shoes and said in a heavy German accent, "Never mind." We played the show in Hamburg the next night in a dumpy little club, but it didn't matter because I was excited to be back in the city I had spent 6 weeks in back in 93. After the gig, I went to check how much things had changed in the last 18 years since I'd lived there. I headed over to my old stomping grounds, the Triangle of Decadence on the Reeperbahn, which consisted of a concert hall called Docks, which was still there, a strip club called the Cat Meow, which was not, and a Burger King, which also was not. It was a surreal experience to see how different everything was, like going back to your childhood home and seeing it painted a different color. I was surprised how small and dead the Reeperbahn seemed, for I remembered it being much bigger and livelier as a 22-year-old. It reminded me of when I returned with the WWE to the Knoxville Coliseum in 2010, after last wrestling there with Smoky Mountain 16 years earlier. The night I worked the match with a broken arm, the full story can be found in my renowned medical thriller, A Lion's Tale, available at a doctor's office near you. The sold-out building had seemed like a stadium, but when I returned, it was like somebody had put the entire arena into the Death Star trash compactor and shrunk it. I got the same feeling about Hamburg, with the exception of the red light district. It was bigger than I remembered and populated with twice the girls lining the streets, waiting to be chosen like they were at an X-rated sock hop. I wandered down the avenue as ladies of the night in all shapes and sizes propositioned me in German. When I told them I only spoke English, they yelled down the street, "American! American!" "I'm from Winnipeg, you idiot." That was the cue for all of the English-speaking women to reposition themselves strategically in my path and ask, "Won't you come into my room? I want to show you all my wares." Some of the girls were gorgeous, and some weren't, but since I was only browsing, like Monte Capuletti, I continued walking until one persistent lass, who resembled a chubbier Janine Garofalo, blocked my way.
"Hello, would you like a date?" she said with a smirk. "We can go upstairs. I'll take you in front of the fire and drain your balls."
I've never heard it described like that before.
"I will drain your balls. No need to waste time, right? If you meet a girl and take her out to dinner, you could spend 100 euros and still not have sex. Give me 50 euros, and I'll drain your balls guaranteed."
Can I get that in writing? Now, I've never been into prostitutes, but if I was, I would have put her first in line due to her amazing sales pitch. With lines like those, she could have sold rehab to Rob Ford. Chapter 31. Three Derelicts. Things were really coming together for Fozzie in every way. We were getting booked on bigger shows, our fan base was growing, our reviews were improving, and our future was so bright we needed to wear shades. I do on stage. But there was one remaining problem. Whenever I watched our live performances on YouTube or saw pictures of us on stage, I realized something ain't quite right. Like on Sesame Street, one of these guys was not like the others. That guy was Sean Delson. He'd never fully adapted to our new image philosophy and stood out like a sore thumb with his average Joe look, baggy t-shirts, and unorthodox stage moves that made him look like a stalking praying mantis. I tried to act as his stylist, banning him from wearing watches or Levi's on stage, and Googling rock and roll clothing stores to help him find proper fitting clothes. But I could tell his patience with my fashion requirements was growing thin. The other issue was he was a very good technical player in the Geddy Lee and Tony Levine mold, but that wasn't the type of bassist we needed. We wanted a dude who could groove like a mofo in the pocket of the musical pants of Rich Ward and Frank Fonseer. But we hadn't come across anybody who could quite do that. Then, Pauly D came along. Mike Portnoy told me that when he was putting together his new band Adrenaline Mob, he'd scouted a bass player in the New Jersey area named Paul DeLeo. Paul was one of those high-in-demand players that had gigged with such legendary artists as Joe Lynn Turner, Ace Frehley, Paul Simon, and Billy Joel. Adrenaline Mob was looking for another guitar player as well, and since Fozzie was between tour cycles, I suggested Rich. From the moment of their first rehearsal, Rich kept telling me about this amazing bass player who'd be perfect for Fozzie. I Googled Pauly, and the first thing I noticed was his image, which blew me away. He had his own thing going on, and with his shoulder-length black hair, black skinny jeans, black vest, black t-shirt, black Chuck Taylors, and black strips of gaffing tape under his eyes, he looked like a cross between Johnny Ramone and Nikki Sixx. I told Rich if Pauly's playing was half as good as his look, he was in. Rich assured me his playing was even better than his gimmick, and he was right. So we made the decision to replace Sean. Switching band members is never an easy thing, and Sean was a great guy and a good friend who had been with us for the better part of 7 years, which made things even harder. But I think it was almost a relief for him when Rich let him go, because it was obvious his heart just wasn't into being in Fozzie anymore. This was evident by the last thing he said to Rich.
"Let's be honest. You and I both know Fozzie will never get any bigger than you are."
Those words lit some major fires inside me, and I've worked my ass off ever since to prove him wrong. We all have, and we've gained mountains of ground since Sean's departure. But, oh, I say, Mama, a little ain't enough for me. We were only getting started. A few months later, Rich decided to leave Adrenaline Mob, took Pauly with him, and finally the lineup we'd been waiting 11 years for was complete. Chris Jericho, Rich Ward, Frank Fonseer, Billy Gray, and Paul DeLeo. Rich was right about Pauly's playing. From the first time we gigged with him, I couldn't believe the difference he made to our sound. His tone, dynamics, stage presence, energy, everything. He was the missing piece of the Fozzie puzzle that we hadn't even realized we were lacking until he joined our band. With Pauly now in our ranks, we had gone from a good band to a dangerous band, and we were ready to take over the world. Our first gigs with Pauly were on the 2011 Uproar Festival tour in Canada, filling in for Seven Dust for a week, with our debut being in Calgary's massive Saddle Dome. It was the first arena show Fozzy had ever played, and it just so happened to be an arena I'd also wrestled in with the WWE. I should call the Guinness people because I think that's some sort of world record, the only guy to ever wrestle and play rock and roll in the Saddle Dome. To celebrate our first arena gig, Rich and I took a picture outside the dome. The irony was that Johnny Cecula, who had signed us as a cover band to Megaforce Records 11 years earlier, always said we'd play arenas someday, and now his prediction had finally come true. Even though we were in the major leagues headlining the second stage of Uproar, we still weren't big enough to warrant our own dressing room and had to change in the Saddle Dome break room. The staff was milling around us when a guy with a tray of popcorn around his neck recognized me and said, "Aren't you Chris Jericho? Wow, I figured you'd have your own private dressing room." Not in this world, pal. At least, not yet. But I was so excited I would have changed in the stands. I knew this wasn't the WWE, where I was at the top of the food chain, and was ready, willing, and able to work my way to the top the same way I had in wrestling. Thankfully, Avenged Sevenfold was headlining Uproar, and singer M. Shadows let me hang out in his private dressing room. M., Matt, and I had become friends after he saw Fozzy at B.B. King's, and we got even closer after A7X came over to my house in Tampa for a barbecue earlier in the tour. Their new album, Nightmare, had recently hit number one on the Billboard charts, and their touring schedule was crazy. So a day off of fun in the sun and a home-cooked meal at Irvine World, Toho TM, was a welcome change. Portnoy had joined Avenged temporarily after their drummer and best friend Jimmy the Rev Sullivan passed away a few months earlier, and when he called and asked if they could come over, the Irvine Five were happy to oblige. Once again, I was impressed by their closeness as all five band members and three of their crew came over together to swim, jet ski, and chow down on some scrumptious steak. Ash, Cheyenne, and Sierra were excited to have the band, as they called them, at our house, and the band was really great with them. Shadows went swimming with my daughters and played Call of Duty with fellow gamer Ash. They even sat together with the exact same zoned-out look on their faces as they played. Ash later told me, "Out of all my friends, Matt is the best at Call of Duty." Jess put together an amazing spread, and I was cooking up some rad steaks a la Jericho while talking to Sinister Gates about Mr. Bungle, as Johnny Christ and Portnoy zipped across the lake on our jet skis. After a few spins, Johnny pulled into shore so Shads could take a turn. Matt stood in the shallow water of the shoreline, pushing the ski out onto the lake horizontally in front of him. I noticed Mike speeding toward shore as if he planned to do a drive-by and spray Shads with water, but it seemed like he was coming in a little too close and a tad too fast. I figured he knew what he was doing, so I turned back to the barbecue, but a few seconds later I heard a loud crash. My heart dropped because I was convinced of what had happened. Mike Portnoy had just killed his bandmate. Time stood still, and I could see the headlines on Blabbermouth.com already. M. Shadows dead in bizarre jet ski accident at Chris Jericho's house. Mike Portnoy replaces drummer. Kills singer. The way Matt had been pushing the ski out in front of himself, I was certain Portnoy had lost control and rammed into him, crushing him between the jet ski and the stone wall that separated the lake from my lawn. I was expecting to see him torn in two halves with his torso on the lawn and his legs sticking up like bloody pipe cleaners between the barricade and the boat. But when I turned around, Matt's legs were, thankfully, still attached to his torso, and he was standing on them. He was laughing nervously with Dan the Body, one of their crew members who had caught the whole incident on video. Mike had indeed been coming into shore too quickly, and when he cranked the ski at the last second, lost control and broadsided Matt's jet ski. But instead of slamming the ski into Matt, and then into the wall behind him, it got caught in the wake and was sucked downward instead of forward, essentially causing it to bob up and down in the water. Shadows had gotten very lucky, and when I asked Portnoy why he had come into shore so fast, he said, I couldn't find the brake. That's because there are no brakes on a jet ski, you big dummy. Mike felt awful and kept apologizing profusely for damaging my ski. But all I cared about was that nobody got hurt. Sure, the side of the ski was smashed in and there were some holes in the fiberglass, but considering the alternative, I was pretty happy about everything. It was only a few days later when I pushed the ski into the water and it sank instantly that I realized how messed up it really was. I called our watercraft guru, Jet Brett, to come over and examine the ski. I thought maybe a seal had been broken or a spark plug had cracked, causing some water to seep in. "Nope," Jet Brett said. "The ski sank because there's a hole in the bottom of it the size of a human head." Turns out Mike had raked the ski over a gaggle of rocks, and I was now the proud owner of a totally worthless watercraft. But like my dad used to say whenever he had a fender bender, it's only a piece of metal. I felt the same way. Besides, we still had an awesome day, and even though I lost a jet ski, I gained the right to bust Portnoy's balls about it forever. "And I'm never, ever gonna let you live this down, Mikey baby. Never." Because we were only filling in for Seven Dust for a few shows, we didn't have a tour bus as usual. So the plan was to fly after the show in Edmonton to our next show in Seattle. The budget for the mini-tour was tight, so to save some money, and because I thought it would be fun, I asked Matt if I could ride to Seattle with Avenged. He agreed, so after the Edmonton show I got on the bus, bearing gifts of Grey Goose vodka and Glenfiddich scotch, our poisons of choice. A few minutes later, Matt Tuck, the singer of Bullet for My Valentine, came on to see what was up. I had just met Tuck the day before and found out that he and his bandmates were huge Rich Ward fans. Matt was too nervous to speak to him at first, so he sent his guitar tech over to break the ice. And Bullet's bass player, Jay James, had the "Ward is My Shepherd" tattooed on his wrist. He had also broken his nose moshing at a Fozzy show in Cardiff 6 years earlier. Tucky and I had hit it off right off the bat, much the same way Shads and I had. The two Matts were good friends already, so we suggested Tuck ride with us to Seattle as well. A man of few words, Matt nodded his head and sat down. He'd come on board with nothing more than the clothes on his back and a bottle of NyQuil. Not exactly the fancy scotch I'd contributed, but it would do. The bus pulled out at midnight, and a dozen of us sat in the front lounge having a few cocktails, telling tall tales, listening to tunes, and just talking about life on the road in general. As the night wore on, the rest of the guys went to bed one by one until it was just me, Gates, and the two Matts. We were all pretty loaded at this point, and the conversation moved in a more serious direction when the subject of Rev's passing came up. I've been a fan of Avenged for years before I actually met them, and was shocked and saddened when he passed away. I sent a message of condolence to them through Portnoy, partly out of respect and partly because I knew what it was like to lose one of your best friends unexpectedly. I still found it hard to talk to random people about the Chris Benoit tragedy, but now that this mutual connection had been discovered, I found it easy to open up to them about Chris's death. I suspect that's the same reason why Shads and Gates were able to confide in me about Rev's passing. Most of the time when someone asks about Chris, a wall goes up and I become very guarded. Because while it's easy to vilify him for the atrocities he committed during the final days of his life, most people didn't know him the way I did. Chris was one of my best friends, and there was so much more to him than the horrible murders he committed, just as there was so much more to Jimmy than the drug addictions that caused him to overdose. It was such a cathartic conversation for me, and I assume for them as well, because there were no judgments, no false sympathies. I told the entire story of Chris's death from my point of view and answered all of their questions. And they did the same about Jimmy's. It took a long time to get all of the emotions out of our systems. The sadness, shock, betrayal, uncertainty, love. The anger we felt toward them for leaving us behind, the anger we felt toward other people for their callous reactions, and the helpless guilt we felt in ourselves for not preventing the tragedies. It was a total cleansing. A bonding moment that I'll never forget. Because sharing these feelings with two guys who'd been through a similar soul-crushing situation helped me to let go. After our melancholy reflections ended, there were two options left. Go to bed or stay up and keep drinking. Gates chose the former, while me and the two Matts, Tuck listened to our conversation in complete silence but heard every word, decided on the latter. The cocktails continued flowing until we had the bright idea to listen to some Helloween, one of Shad's and my favorite bands, so much so that we got matching tattoos of the Helloween pumpkin on the Sunset Strip a few years later, and sing along to the incredible vocals of Michael Kiske, which is never a good idea when you're fucked up drunk. After a little time, the combination of the long hours of talking, the hard alcohol and the high-pitched screaming took its toll on all our voices, leaving us with nothing more than squeaky rasps. We had the next day off, thankfully, because in one fell swoop of a drunken night, all three singers from Avenged Sevenfold, Bullet for My Valentine, and Fozzie had blown out their voices. Maybe some of Tucky's NyQuil could have helped? The sun was up when we arrived at the U.S. border and filed off the bus to go through customs. I was dead tired, my throat was killing me, and my eyes were burning as the three of us sat on a bench in the corner of the customs area waiting for our passports to clear. I looked around the room and noticed the rest of the band had subtly distanced themselves from us, and I don't blame them. With the way we looked and smelled, I wouldn't have been surprised if we were denied entry forever. Then I saw three guys on the other side of the room who were in even worse shape than us. They looked like three derelicts, and I knew there was no way customs were going to let them through. I looked at one guy in particular who looked about 1,000 years old with hair matted to the side of his head and deep dark bags supporting his cherry red bloodshot eyes. Wow, is that guy ever a mess, I thought to myself. Then I noticed the guy looked vaguely familiar, as did the tattooed dude to his left and the long-haired bloke to his right. I realized I was looking in a mirror. The three derelicts were us. Chapter 32, Bonus Track. There's an Iron Maiden song called Total Eclipse that was recorded in 1982 during the Number of the Beast sessions. It's a great track that contains all the classic elements and techniques that make up a killer, pun intended, Maiden tune. But for some reason, it wasn't included on the original version of the album. It became a lost song until it finally resurfaced on a Number of the Beast re-release years later as a bonus track. There are a few of these lost songs from my previous books, good stories that for whatever reason didn't make the final cut of ALT or UD. Most of them weren't included because they were only mildly entertaining or just plain irrelevant, but there's one story in particular that I could never figure out why it didn't make it. After all these years, I'm now going to rectify that situation and include the story, as a bonus track, if you will. Back in the spring of 1996, I weaseled my way onto the lineup of the World Peace Festival, a multi-promotional wrestling show promoted in Los Angeles by Antonio Inoki, the president of New Japan Pro Wrestling. I wasn't getting paid much and had to provide my own way there, but it was worth the gamble as I was a free agent, hoping to get a job with New Japan or even WCW, who were also involved at the show. My plan worked. It was at that Peace Festival that Benoit first introduced me to Eric Bischoff, and the rest is history. Conan, a friend from my time working in Mexico, was running an AAA show the next day in Tijuana, and asked if I would do him a favor and wrestle it. I'd never worked for any company in Mexico besides CMLL for Paco Alonso, the promoter who brought me to Mexico City in 93. I considered Conan's offer for a few days, wondering if doing the single show would betray Paco and hurt my chances of going back to CMLL if I ever needed to. I decided it wouldn't, plus I could use the $500 Conan was offering to pay some of my Peace Festival travel expenses. I agreed to the gig, but made Conan promise to throw in a hotel room and a plane ticket from San Diego back to LAX, so I could catch the flight home to Calgary that I'd already booked. I wrestled the show and was surprised by the reaction I received, or maybe I should say the lack of reaction. Even though I'd only been off Mexican television for a year, I'd never worked for AAA or in Tijuana, and you could tell. I was expecting a returning hero's welcome, but just like when I returned to FMW in 92, nobody knew who I was. Plus, I was booed out of the building whenever I tried to work the crowd, which wasn't a good sign since I was supposed to be a babyface. After the match, I grabbed my $500, packed up the pieces of my broken ego, and headed back to the hotel. I briefly considered going to see the infamous Tijuana Donkey Show, but decided to catch some sleep instead as I had an early morning lobby call to take me to the airport. I didn't have my actual plane ticket yet, but Conan told me my ride would be there at 8 a.m., and I assumed I'd get it then. The hotel Conan had booked was quite seedy, but since I was only going to be there for a few hours, I was fine with it. Fine, that is, until I went into the room and found La Parca sprawled out on my bed. Well, I guess it wasn't officially my bed, as there was only one, along with a ratty old couch. Parca was obviously more into the first-come, first-served way of doing things, instead of the he's-a-guest-in-our-country way of thinking, and had no intention of giving up the room's only bed. So I settled down on the lumpy, onion-smelling couch, which had probably soaked up the DNA of many a thrifty Lothario, and tried to relax. Then Parca went into the bathroom for over 40 minutes, doing who knows what, and when he emerged there was no water left. And by that I don't mean no hot water, I mean no water of any kind. Did I mention La Parca as an ugly duck? Imagine Donkey from Shrek, or Donkey from the Donkey Show, with bad acne, and you'll get an idea of what he kind of looks like. That has nothing to do with my narrative, by the way. I just had to throw that out there. Anyway, I slept horribly due to a combination of the lumpy onion couch and LaDonka's bleeding snores, so I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there when the morning finally came. I went to the lobby ready to go at 7:45 a.m., a full 15 minutes early, and was quite annoyed when the driver didn't pick me up until 8:30 a.m. "What time is my flight?" I said, and he assured me we were headed straight there with plenty of time. His tone worried me as I had a 7 p.m. flight out of LAX to Calgary and had used my frequent flyer points to book it. If I missed it, I was screwed. We drove in silence through the city, passing the infamous Donkey Show bar, until we pulled up at the border, the one you see in every movie that takes place in Tijuana. While it was a famous landmark and the gateway into the United States, it wasn't an airport.
"Here you go. The bus station is right over there," the Vato said, pointing to a brown brick terminal across the road.
"Bus station? I thought we were headed to the airport."
"Don't know anything about that, Mono,"
he said, handing me a ticket and pulling away, tires screeching.
I couldn't believe that Conan would screw me like this after all these years I'd known him. But considering that I was standing in a parking lot in TJ with no way to L.A. other than the bus ticket in my hand, I'd say I'd been stiffed harder than Sasha Gray. Bottom line was I had a flight to catch out of LAX, so I had no time to mess about. I walked into the bus station and was directed over to my transportation, which wasn't a bus at all, but a white Suburban. The driver was wearing a 12-gallon hat with a 12-gallon mustache to match and motioned me to get in. I warily climbed into the back with my head ducked down so I wouldn't hit the ceiling, and took a seat in the last row. I hardly had any room in the cramped back seat, and that got even worse when someone else got on, and then someone else, and so on. Pretty soon all of the space in the 16-seat van was gone, and I felt like a cow in the back of a cattle car. Everyone was sitting with their bags on their laps, and my $50 Target special looked like a Louis Vuitton compared to the cardboard boxes and garbage bags the other passengers were holding. They were all speaking Spanish at 100 miles per hora, and then, for no apparent reason, they started singing. I felt like the hitman sitting between Lloyd, Harry, and the Mexican hitchhikers in Dumb and Dumber, except I had no rat poison to put myself out of my misery.
"Mock. See. Bird. See."
Then the driver put on some mariachi music, and the passengers went loco, clapping along and doing those ay noises that only true Mexicanos can make. The fiesta was in full swing until we pulled over into a U.S. immigration checkpoint. We got off and lined up outside the van so the federales could check our credentials. The officer had probably seen nothing but Mexican passports all day, so his head was down as he gave a cursory glance to each person and mumbled a few words in Spanish. When he got to me, he looked at my passport and did a double take.
"Canadian? What are you doing here?"
he asked with total surprise.
"Just trying to get to L.A., I said dejectedly. "Why didn't you take a bus? These transport vans can be dangerous."
I explained my predicament and asked if he could give me a ride to LAX. He shook his head no and told me to be careful the rest of the way, as I cursed Conan under my breath with every English, Spanish, and Klingon curse word, Baktag, I knew. A few hours later, after making 16 different stops for each passenger in 16 different parts of SoCal, I finally got to LAX and made my flight back to Calgary. I was furious at Conan, but the van ride wasn't a complete waste, as I'd had two epiphanies along the way. One, I'd never work for him again. Two, I still wanted to see that damn donkey show. Chapter 33, Dead Man to Burning Man. In January 2010, after 6 months of rehab and recovery, Edge was ready to come back to the WWE. He was going to return as a surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble and eliminate me quickly. I'd been keeping our angle alive by dropping his name and burying him on a semi-weekly basis for being injury-prone, and telling him to stay away from me if he ever came back, because he would get hurt worse. Since it was only January, we still had enough time to salvage our angle and make the match a headlining attraction at Mania. But we'd have to act fast. So I had an idea that would make our bout a headliner instantly. We would wrestle for the world title. If Edge came back and won the Royal Rumble, he'd be guaranteed a match at Mania for the world championship currently held by The Undertaker. But Taker was scheduled for a rematch with HBK of their classic from the year before, and didn't need the title to make their storyline stand out. Therefore, if I won the belt at the Elimination Chamber, I could face Edge for it on the grandest stage of them all. Good plan, right? But it was easier said than done. Vince hadn't made up his mind if he wanted to go with Edge or have Batista win the Rumble and challenge Cena for his world title. There were two world titles at the time, like in boxing. I thought it was a better story if Edge came back from a serious injury and won the Rumble. It would make his return that much more of an inspirational tale and was the perfect way for Adam to come back as a babyface, since Vince still wanted him to be the new face of SmackDown. I wanted to speak to Vince to give him my thoughts before he made his final decision, feeling I'd be remiss if I didn't at least try. So I phoned him from the lobby of the Disney Animal Adventure Resort while on vacation with the Irvine Five, but I kept losing reception and it was pissing him off. He didn't like losing control of any situation. He doesn't even like sneezing. And the more my signal cut out, the angrier he got and the less chance I had of selling him on my idea. The reception got better, and after my pitch, he said, "Well, that's certainly an option." This was Vince's for, "I'm thinking about it, so don't bother me with this again." So I went back to watching giraffes with my kids and awaited his decision. A few days later, I got a call from Michael Hayes saying that Vince had made up his mind to go my way. Edge would win the Rumble. I'd beat Taker at the Elimination Chamber, and Edge and I would wrestle for the world title at WrestleMania 26. Edge made his surprise return in Atlanta to a monstrous reaction and tossed me out of the Rumble immediately. Even though I'd only lasted a few minutes, Fozzie's Martyr No More was the theme song for the PPV, so I had that going for me. The next month in St. Louis, the plan was I'd pin The Undertaker in the Elimination Chamber to become the world champion after an interfering Shawn Michaels nailed him with a super kick. I was honored, for it was a big deal to beat The Undertaker in any situation as he was still the locker room leader and had the respect of every single employee in the WWE. The fruit thing was, Taker never abused his position or his pull, but he also had no problem reminding people of it when the situation was warranted. This was evident during our rehearsal for the Chamber match with me, Taker, Punk, Morrison, Mysterio, and Truth. When Truth and Ray showed up a half hour late, Taker gave them both a tongue-lashing, specifically laying into Truth, who was getting the biggest push of his career.
"Is this how you're going to prove to me that you want to be a top guy? Show up late? If I can be here on time, you sure as hell can too. This won't happen again, will it?"
Truth stared at his boots and mumbled that it most certainly would not. Nobody ever wanted to get on Taker's bad side, but Truth wasn't the only one to end up there that day. While he got on Taker's shit list for being late, the other guy ended up on it by setting Taker on fire. Literally.
I was the third of the six performers to enter the 2010 Elimination Chamber and was standing in my pot of thunder awaiting Undertaker's entrance. I was stationed directly in front of the stage, so I had a bird's-eye view of the rampway as the Phenom entered the arena. It never ceased to amaze me how ominous his entrance was, and I was still in awe as he came down the ramp staring straight ahead unwaveringly, his arms slowly swinging by his side like an undead Terminator. Suddenly, a pillar of fire shot up directly in front of him, and he dropped character immediately and dodged to his left like a bug in a zapper, straight into the path of another flame. The second column engulfed him briefly, and he hopped forward, right into yet another burst. This time his long leather trench coat caught on fire, and he batted it out quickly as he took off into a dead sprint. When he finally got to the chamber, it was obvious he'd gone from Dead Man to Burning Man. The skin on his chest was a bright pink, and his coat had melted, the ends shriveling up like a burnt black plastic solo cup, and was still smoking as he peeled it off. Doc Amon hurried over to see how badly he'd been burned, but after a few minutes of conversation, Taker convinced him he could still do the match. As any of you who have burned even the end of your fingertip can attest, it hurts like hell. Now imagine how much pain Taker was in with his entire upper body turning as red as a little Corvette, his skin stretched taut and shiny like it was going to split wide open. He was the last man scheduled to enter the chamber, so he had to wait in his pod for 20 minutes with nothing to do but pour bottles of water over his head and think about how much agony he was in. We went through the match until finally it was his turn to enter the ring. I'd been watching him the entire time, pacing the tiny pod like a caged beast waiting to be set free. Finally, his door opened, and we fed his comeback, but I could tell he was hurting big time, and I was concerned about even touching him. At one point, I bumped him down, and when I went for the cover, I noticed the exposed skin on his chest had now blistered and was bubbling up in the more severe areas.
"Are you okay, man? Do we need to change anything?" I whispered pointedly in his ear.
"No, kid. Let's stay with what we've got."
I could feel the heat radiating off his body and could smell his burnt hair. This dude was a tough motherfucker. We continued on for another few minutes until I eventually put him in the Walls of Jericho. The fans were going crazy in support of their hero, but all I could think of was how bad it must hurt Take to have his burnt flesh pressed down onto the canvas. Finally, he made it to the ropes, then chokeslammed me and signaled for his last ride powerbomb finisher. At this point, HBK came out from under the ring and super-kicked him in the face. I warily covered him, knowing that Michaels would have no problem kicking me in the face as well. But he didn't, and I got the three count to become the world champion for the sixth time. I rushed to the back in a hail of boos and headed straight to the trainer's room, where Taker and Vince were already sitting solemnly in silence, although I could tell they were in the middle of a deep conversation. Finally, Undertaker spoke up calmly.
"I don't want him to apologize, Vince. I don't want any excuses. I just never want to see him again, because if I do, I'll kill him."
I could tell by the tone of his voice that he was completely serious, and Vince felt the same way. But that was the last time we ever saw the pyro guy. He was fired, pun intended, on the spot, and escorted out of the building immediately. I never found out why the pyro had been set off 3 times in a row directly in front of the Undertaker, but it was definitely a major fuck-up, and he was lucky to still be alive. But he paid a steep price with second-degree burns all over his upper body, and spent a few days in the St. Louis burn unit and a few more months off the road to heal. He later told me that the only things that saved him from serious permanent injuries, or even death, were 1. The big-brimmed hat he wore to the ring, which covered his hair and half his face. 2. The fact that he'd wet his hair before he went through the curtain. 3. The long leather overcoat. Seeing that coat up close, I realized how much it had shielded him from the flames. It was in tatters and looked like it had shrunk 3 sizes. The leather was bubbled up and split from the lining in places as if it had been put in an industrial paper shredder. I called him later and told him he was so tough he should have been born in Winnipeg instead of Texas, and he laughed, painfully. I already had nothing but respect for Mark Calloway, but my esteem for the man went to a whole new level that day. He'd almost been burned alive and still put me over for the world title. We also had a killer match due to our excellent chemistry, something we found out months earlier during our first singles match. It had been in Sheffield, England, the day after my 39th birthday, and I'd tied one on badly the night before, spending most of the day on a couch in a dark room in the bowels of the arena. I set my iPhone alarm to not sleep through the show and felt like I was going to puke at any moment. A few hours later, Taker and I tore the house down in a match I considered to be one of the best of my career, and I even included it on my first WWE DVD. The fact that it took us over a decade to get a singles match together was like working in a coal mine for years and finding a rare diamond that you'd always heard about but never seen. He was so easy and fluid to work with and knew exactly what his character was, that it was the proverbial night off to be in the ring with him. It was fun to reverse out of each other's trademark moves, like me spin-kicking him in the face as he hit the ropes to deliver his patented corner clothesline, or reversing his Hell's Gate, the go-go platter, which morphed into the poo-poo platter, submission into the walls, which he then reversed into the poo-poo platter and got the win when I tapped out. When I came back into Gorilla, Taker was sitting in a chair with a towel around his neck and a big goofy grin on his face.
That was awesome, man. Really fucking great. Vince knows he has something with us.
I was ecstatic that he'd enjoyed it so much, and even more so when he gave me the biggest compliment possible.
I would work with you any time, Chris.
That was all I needed to hear from one of the greatest performers of all time, even though we never wrestled with each other again. Chapter 34. Superior DNA. After beating Taker for the world title, it was time to focus on the much-awaited Jericho versus Edge match we'd been planning for years. We didn't have much of an angle at the start except the built-in story of the two former tag champions at war, but Vince fixed that quickly by adding a different dimension. He called me into his office to discuss a promo I'd written about Edge, our successes and triumphs, and Edge's biggest failure, the injury that destroyed what could have been the greatest tag team of all time. I could tell by the look of repulsion and disbelief on Vince's face that he wasn't buying it.
Come on, Chris, you can do better than this. This is generic bullshit. I want something with some meat on it. I want you to talk about DNA.
Okay. I wasn't sure what he meant by DNA. Did he want a definition? A biology lesson?
I want you to talk about Edge and his faulty DNA. How he always gets hurt because of his weak DNA, and you never get hurt because of your superior DNA.
Vince is a big believer in the law of the jungle and how only the strong survive. He often made the analogy that even the mightiest of lions, when injured, would be hunted and killed by the rest of the pack. So I went back to the drawing board to try and give him what he wanted. I looked up the definition of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, and built it from there. I wrote a pretty unique promo about how DNA was the building blocks of a man's constitution, and much like height, looks, or intelligence, you were either blessed with good DNA or you weren't. Edge had been cursed and was injury-prone, while I never had to take one day off for an injury throughout my entire WWE career due to my superior DNA. I finished the promo with one of my all-time favorite lines. I don't know what it's like to make a triumphant return, Edge, because I've never been injured. I'm too busy winning titles. Oh, snap! I love that quote because it was the perfect summary of our entire angle, and once again, Vince's seemingly ridiculous idea ended up being a great way to promote our match. WrestleMania was going to be held on March 28, 2010, in the University of Phoenix Stadium, in Glendale, Arizona, with a quadruple main event of Vince versus Bret Hart, Cena versus Batista, Michaels versus Undertaker 2, and Jericho versus Edge. It was slated to be one of the biggest manias ever, and a few weeks before the show, I was asked to fly on Vince's private jet from Raw in Nashville to Phoenix for a press conference. It was about a 4-hour flight, and Vince, Cena, Kofi Kingston, Laurinaitis, and I passed the time by playing cards, listening to AC/DC and the Rolling Stones, of course, and drinking straight Jack Daniels. After the confrontation with HBK in France, I no longer drank down brown alcohol, as Jack and Jericho still didn't get along, But I was hanging with the boss, and there wasn't anything else on the plane, so I indulged. Bad idea, because after 4 hours of being on the same aircraft, Jack kicked Jericho's ass. I was completely shit-faced, all of us were, when the plane landed, and I was in a nasty mood. Drunkico was back, and he was pissed. Literally. The plane pulled up on the tarmac, and we stayed aboard for a few extra minutes to finish up our drinks. Kofi got up to leave, and Vince made some sort of a jokey comment along the lines of, "Maybe you'll get over one of these days."